It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is William C. Anderson. I am an activist and an author, and just a person seeking to make a difference in the world.
Awesome. Yeah, we're going to be talking about some of your written work and more theoretical stuff in general, and of course, just everything that's going on right now, and we're really excited to have you on the program. But just to kind of get us started off, tell us about yourself and how you became radicalized and involved in anarchist politics.
I've been organizing off and on and taking part in movements for a good amount of time now, since I was a teenager. So eventually, I became kind of frustrated in my teens because I was doing a lot of organizing and spending a lot of time around a lot of different left circles. I started, you know, reading radical texts pretty early in my life, and I kind of grew up with a lot of that around in many ways, as far as terms of, you know, just really studying Black history. And so I became kind of frustrated because I felt like I was around a lot of people who were thinking that replicating the past without critiquing it or critiquing ourselves was the answer. And this was, again, in my teen. So I always wanted to struggle, you know, alongside people who wanted to go beyond the past and not really like cosplay it or worship it. And so I spent a lot of time in a place where I didn't really know where I was exactly politically. And I kind of, you know, went through a variety of identifications before I got to this point. So what got me to this point was, you know, after spending all this time in movements and organizing, you know, around this, the domination of like the nonprofit industrial complex and hierarchy and statism and, you know, this fame driven activism, I rejected these things. And, you know, because I experienced a lot of the worst of what they produce. And so a major turning point for me was, the passage of Arizona's SB 1070. And that was a law that gave the police the authority to detain people based on the suspicion that they could be undocumented. And so when that happened, it was the legalization of racial profiling. And that was something I knew would be a threat to Black people, even if, you know, they weren't undocumented. So I understood myself as a Black person who's not from an immigrant background to occupy a category in this country that was not a true form of real, you know, citizenship with the benefits that are supposed to come with it. And because I understood myself to occupy that category, I started thinking through that. And, you know, I started putting a lot of things together, and I arrived at anarchism. I had, you know, been in all sorts of different circles. You know, I'd been around Leninists and Maoists and Stalinists and all sorts of different folks on the left who identified many different ways. And I came to anarchism through thinking a lot of the time I was in the immigrant rights movement, thinking a lot of that time about citizenship and about blackness. And yeah, so I'd say around, I think 2012, I met Lorenzo Irvin, and he was a huge, huge impact on my life because I, again, had been thinking about anarchism and considering it, but he really drove it home for me. And the way he did that was, you know, it had been a workshop I had been putting on with a friend. I was co-leading with a friend, and he came and visited, and he spoke to us about Black anarchism and his work and the things he had accomplished in his life. And I just felt like it all made a lot of sense. And I had been pushing back on a lot of the things that I had been around for such a long time. And so it really fell in line in a great way and made me feel fairly certain that anarchism was a practice and was a politic that I was going to need to learn more about and to study more effectively in order to try to take myself to a better place than what I had been around and what I had been seeing for a while. So that's basically it.
And you actually just interviewed Lorenzo, right, for a publication?
Yeah, I did. I interviewed him. I interviewed him just on my own and then published it with Black Rose La Negra. And it was a really good interview. It was a long interview that I think people should definitely read. And, you know, I can talk about that a little bit more as we get into some different things during this discussion.
For sure. Yeah. We'll definitely link that in the show notes. And there was also a call for people to help him out monetarily. Is that still going on, or did it reach its goal currently?
We definitely reached the goal. We fundraised a lot of money for him and Janina Irvin, his partner. So it was really great to see an outpouring of love, and it showed how much people really respect Lorenzo and his work. It was really inspiring.
Awesome, that's great. Well, tell us about the book that you've published, As Black as Resistance. It's out on AK Press. Tell us about the book. What are some of the core ideas and kind of arguments inside of it?
So, As Black as Resistance is the book I co-authored with Zoe Simudzi. And it's a book that is an expansion of the essay, The Anarchism of Blackness. And so that essay we wrote prior to the book did really well in terms of reception and dissemination. So what is Black as Resistance is doing is expanding on some of the themes that were present in the essay, or maybe alluded to in one way or the other. So there's the discussion of blackness, what it means to be black in this predicament we're thinking through. There's the discussion of land, self-defense, and also movement politics. So I think when you read the book, much like the essay, it serves as a warning of sorts. It's doing different types of work simultaneously. And, you know, at the same time, Zoe and I were really determined to try to write a manifesto that would lament the lack of a left opposition in the USA and encourage people to consider anarchism or just consider radical politics in general, too. So it wasn't supposed to be a sectarian text. It was supposed to be a statement addressing needs. You know, we saw a need to address party politics and the anarchism of blackness. We saw a need to talk about black land claims and aspirations and indigenous sovereignty. We saw a need to talk about self-defense and conflict. We saw a need to talk about movement issues. So we're seeing a lot of this stuff play out in real time now in a way that can't be ignored. And basically we were trying to get ahead of some of the things that are happening right now. And that was really, really the origin of what inspired the book, again, with the anarchism of blackness. We were responding to, you know, the neo-fascist moment that we're in, and trying to say, you know, hey, let's form a real opposition. Let's do something to push back in a way that is much more effective than what, you know, we've seen on the left in recent years. And so we were trying to encourage people, really.
So the book's been out for a while. What do you think of the response that's gotten?
Oh, man, the response to As Black as Resistance has been overwhelming. The amount of love shown has been really, really inspiring. We had no idea that the book was going to get such an amazing reception. People have told us that the book radicalized them. We've had people tell us that, you know, this their favorite book. We've had people tell us, you know, all sorts of really, really phenomenal things about the text. And it is really amazing. I'm always really happy to see how much people love the book. And overall, I think that the response from folks who've read it has just been exactly what you would want it to be. So I think a lot of people have appreciated it in a way that is very gratifying.
Well, that's great. Yeah, it seemed to definitely come out at a time when it could definitely have like such a wide audience and is just like so needed right now.
Absolutely.
So as we've covered on this podcast before with other guests, there definitely seems to be a growth in Black anarchist ideas. There's lots of books being published. We've had different authors on here, different projects, different people organizing. And what is your overall take on this growth? What does it point to? And I'm just curious your thoughts on it in general.
Well, I think if we're going to talk about the growth of Black anarchism in this moment, that we really have to talk about some history first. And really to understand Black anarchism, you have to look at what was happening at a pivotal point in Black history, which was the 60s and 70s, and the civil rights and Black power movement. So there's no one interpretation of what Black anarchism is or isn't, or where it even starts, really. But a prominent understanding is based on the gradual breaking away and development that happened outside of the Black struggles of the 60s and 70s, like the civil rights and Black power movement. So people who had been taking part in these movements and, you know, in the Black Panther Party diverged from what they understood to be limitations. They rejected assimilationism and of the civil rights movement. They rejected the hierarchical nature and charismatic and messianic leadership models. They rejected, you know, centralization and statism in favor of anarchism. So some of the people we're talking about here who'd end up being really influential in this regard are Lorenzo Kamboa Irvin. You know, we're talking about Ashanti Alston. We're talking about Kwesi Balogun, Martin Sostry, Ojori Lutelo. You know, these were Panthers who became disillusioned with the things they saw happening in the party. And they turned away from Leninism and Maoism toward the development of Black and New African anarchism. And that's something that distinguishes Black anarchism from, you know, classical European anarchism, right? So it's a breakaway from the revolutionary Black power movement, as opposed to simply being an effort to diversify classical anarchism, which it clearly holds things in common with, but it's Black-centered, to be specific, to Black people in our unique condition. And so this has grown into many different things today in terms of interpretations and politics, and that's what we're seeing right now. I think that there has been a lot of things bubbling for quite some time now. And I think that also that speaks to some of the reason that the anarchism of Blackness might have been received so well, because I think that that essay was written at just, I think the timing was just really right. And I think that that was part of it. So I think that there was a lot of people who were feeling similarly. And I think that there was quite a few Black people around the country who were feeling very disillusioned with many aspects of the left, including predominantly, you know, white anarchist spaces. And so folks who were identifying with that essay have expressed a similar feeling that we had. And so it just showed that it was much bigger than maybe anyone could have anticipated. And so there was already a lot of things happening with folks before we published that. And I think that right now, the different tendencies that we're seeing developed, a lot of the different groups and a lot of the different ideas that we're seeing are the natural result of that history that I just talked about leading up to this moment, where we're seeing, you know, where we're in the midst of resurgent fascism, but people don't necessarily feel like what has been done thus far, like has been sufficient. So I think that this is a time that calls for new ideas, new sets of politics, and new approaches. And I think that that has a lot to do with this moment, because Black anarchism, quote unquote, if you want to call it that, or whatever you want to call it, it comes out of that realization that I'm talking about, that, hey, what's happening isn't necessarily enough, and we want to get past certain limitations. We want to get past dogma. We want to get past these sorts of limitations to actually make revolutionary change.
How do you think this could continue to grow, and in what way would you want to see it continue to grow?
One thing I've learned talking to Lorenzo and Janina Urban is this. Anarchists have to expose the contradiction, and we have to work very hard to serve the community and meet people's material needs. And we have to make sure that people know what mutual aid and organizing against the state and its violence is all about. We need to do everything that the state is not doing for communities. And so we have to ask people, what, you know, what does the community need? We have to be in touch with our communities. We have to, make sure that as many types of survival programs that we can develop as possible, exist, and let people know what our politics are through the work that we're doing. So there's plenty of need to be met. And, you know, you don't just do something and, you know, not make your politics a part of it. So I think the Panthers were really effective in showing us how to build a massive movement that meets people's needs. And, you know, there's a ton of need right now around food and housing and healthcare. And, you know, Lorenzo said in that recent interview I did with him that we need to build a survival economy. And so that's really what we're talking about here. So, like, the counter institutions have to be established so that people have an alternative. So, you know, there's a lot of people on the left that think that organizing means, you know, debating all day and being condescending towards liberals. They think that it's like some social club, or they act really cultish. And, you know, you have people online on social media who spend most of their days like arguing about states and worshiping the past while the present is right on top of them and what's being done about it. You know, so this isn't it. Like, we need to have better internal critique than that. And maybe we should be asking ourselves why so many people think in a certain way and what we can be doing to change that reality instead of just talking down and being condescending to people who may not be where we're at. So that was actually something I posted online recently. I asked what alternative is being offered to people, because we can't just tell people that they're wrong every day during a crisis and say, go read, you know, a book and not meet people's material needs. One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about recently is how in this particular moment we have to really look at the fact that the left is in a unique position to make a lot of major differences, like to make a major difference. And the reason I say that is because a lot of people are disillusioned with the two-party system. You see it all the time. There's a lot of confusion, and a lot of people are saying, well, I don't want to, you know, vote for the Dems. Like, I can't stand Trump. What do I do? And that's where the work that we're supposed to be doing to really radicalize people and pull them out of this trap that is electoral politics, that's where that's supposed to be happening. But instead, we see a lot of really limited thinking and a lot of condescension. And I think that it's really important to actually, again, like I was just saying, create the alternative and meet people's material needs. If we're not doing that, then we're failing, because you can't, like, you can't tell people to pull out and to withdraw and to divest from something when you have not offered an alternative and have not created a space for people to feel safe and to have their needs met. So that's what we need to be building. That's the survival economy. That is what's absolutely needed right now. And I think that a lot of the growth of anarchism, particularly black anarchists, should be directed towards that. And I think that is definitely happening in many many regards. And I hope that it only continues to grow until we see something that is really, really effective, and we can start making those changes.
We're going to talk about mutual aid programs in a bit, but you know, you brought up the idea of the solidarity economy, and this makes me think of when we had somebody from the Black Socialists of America. They come from more or less an anarchist, or they would say a libertarian socialist position, and they're involved in also groups like Cooperation Jackson. I'm curious, like, the work that Cooperation Jackson is doing, would you point to that as something that kind of prefigures that, like a solidarity economy? Or is there other projects that are happening right now we could point to that kind of like fleshes that out a little bit?
I think that I don't know enough about Cooperation Jackson. I went to Jackson a while back and I wanted to check out Cooperation Jackson, but I can't speak to them being an example because I'm not informed enough. I will say that I think that what is happening all around the country with what we're seeing with a lot of the mutual aid initiatives that have popped up and that have been really effective in this moment, I think that that is a prime example of what I'm talking about. But I think that also taking that to the next level means having a lot more coordination and communication across states, as well as engaging in a much more strong political message about what these programs are, what they come from, the history, and why it's happening. If you're serving people's needs and meeting people's needs, and not also speaking to efforts of to politicize people in the process, then I think that that is a shortcoming. So I think that it is largely happening in many ways, but I think it has to become a lot more coordinated and political in nature and connected. I think that we have to connect a lot of the things that are happening in our communities to actually start building what we know needs to be built.
Well, just to go back to the book for a second, Black as a Resistance was published pre-rebellion. I'm just curious, what would you say in terms of your ideas, either in the book or in general, have been either affirmed or challenged in the wake of the uprising?
I think that most of the book has been affirmed, honestly. I think that that's been part of the reason it's been as well received as it has. I've seen a lot of people, you know, message me or post online excerpts from the book that directly pertain to the current predicament that we're in with the upcoming election and with a lot of the reactions we're seeing from the right. And, you know, things like talking about, you know, the nonprofit industrial complex and self-defense are especially relevant right now because that is, you know, crucial. Thinking about having to defend ourselves is absolutely crucial right now based on what we're seeing, and thinking about how nonprofits have really steered a lot of our movements in a very limited direction is crucial right now because people are looking for ways to spend their time and exert their energy that are productive and actually, you know, making an actual change. But for so long, nonprofits and, you know, celebrity activists have sucked up a lot of that energy and co-opted people. So I think that a lot of those things that are elements in the book are really on point. And I think that it's been pretty good about you know, maintaining its relevance in this moment. I'm satisfied with it for the most part. I think that anything can be better for sure. And I think that there are definitely things in the book that maybe could have been explained more thoroughly or unpacked a little bit more, but it's also meant to be short and really, really easy to read and digest. So I think that for the most part, it's been doing what it's supposed to do in this moment.
Anti-fascism for short, that's Antifa. So if you hate on that, David Duke must be your teacher. I'm trying to see some UNITY like Latifah. That's kind of hard with Donald Trump as they lead. 5 years for some weed, now they legalizing reefer. Hate it when we speak, but our music on they speakers. Hate it when we kneel, but they love buying our sneakers. Shut up and dribble while they killing all your people. Might catch a session in the hood with the homies, but I'd rather catch sessions in the hood with the homies, or maybe Stephen Miller, or maybe Mike Pence. I'm trying to punch Richard Spencer with the strength of Richard Depp. So long live Heather, I'ma say that line forever. She gave her life so we can make tomorrow better. Oh, I heard you proud, boy. You really proud, boy. I'll punch you in your lip, leave you leaking from the mouth, boy. Y'all ain't even deep, unless you're backed up by police. Bigger threats on these streets, that don't mean you get to speak. Shut it down when y'all around, nothing to talk about. If you out to kill my people, I'ma turn them tables round like fire to the fascists. Fire to the fascists. Fire to the fascists. Fire to the fascists. Yeah. Pinochet was wrong, but the fuck the right. That include the liberals, black, Latino, and white. Anybody that put a price on your hard work, a day profiting while you struggling to make it to payday. Labor that you gave and paid for, they vacay. Workers versus the bosses, I'm Chicago on May Day. Haymarket struggle gave us 8 hour work days. Free market hustlers want us hungry and thirsty. No love for fascists, no love for head fans. No love for anyone furthering my oppression. Poder a la mujeres, make power collectivist. Anything else?
There was recently a study of Zoomers and younger millennials, which we talked about, and it's going down. And specifically, they talked to people of different racial groups, and it was kids that were between ages 19 and 30, and they found that 20% of African American youth favored revolution as the best way to change things. And also, it said that 1 in 4 of the kids that they talked to had taken part in recent protests. I'm just curious, you know, does this number seem high to you? What are your thoughts on, you know, what appears to be an indication that there's, you know, a huge revolutionary potential in youth right now, especially young black youth?
Yeah, I mean, I think that number is a really solid number. I don't know if I would say that it's really high, or what I would feel it is, because I don't really know. One thing I will say is that I think a lot of the young people who are really out here in the streets and who are ready to take a part in everything that's going on are extremely inspiring. I've seen so many young people talk about what they think about the state of this world and what needs to happen in a way that has been mind blowing to me. I did a class actually that I taught with a group of people I was working with on the history of policing earlier in the lockdown. And when I was doing that class, I was talking to young people as young as, you know, 12 years old, and they were extremely smart. There were young people who were super well versed in radical text and history, and it was really inspiring. It was a very clarifying moment for me and my understanding of a lot of things. So I think that what ultimately is going to be happening is there's going to be a lot of frustration and anger about this situation and the way it disrupted the lives of so many young people and what's supposed to be promised to them. I think about it a lot because, you know, there's all of these things that we're told we're supposed to experience as young people in our youth. You know, we're supposed to like go to prom and, you know, have these experiences with our friends and go on trips and do a lot of different things that, you know, are just like considered indicators that, you know, you've had the official young person fun experience. And while those are things that are not ever promised to many people, that are, you know, experiencing, you know, poverty or other things that may deter you from having certain experiences that every young person is supposed to have. It's going to be much, much more widespread, obviously, right now because of the pandemic. And so I think that that's going to create a wave of disillusionment and anger and resentment. And it should, because this is based on the failings of the state and the society, and this is what capitalism breeds. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of young people asking questions and wanting to have something that is much better than anything that would put them in this sort of situation, because this is really disgusting. The United States is, you know, it's a joke. Like this is raggedy. Like this is one of the most unbelievably nonsensical situations that we could ever imagine. And people are so stuck in this mindset of exceptionalism that they refuse to believe that it's even happening. And so a lot of young people who are pushing back against that and who are thinking revolutionarily, that's great. Like we need a lot of that, because this is ultimately an indication when we see it. This is ultimately an indication that a lot of young people are going to be helping create the world that we would hope to see and live in. So I think that it's important that we all engage with young people who are arriving at these conclusions about everything that's happening, and that we work to actually foster that and encourage that in young people who aren't necessarily there yet. So I think that it has a lot of potential, and I think that it's really great.
Well, you were recently on NPR talking about anarchism along with Kim Kelly, who we've also had on this program. One thing I noticed was that a lot of people that were calling into the show and kind of asking questions were, I mean, this is pretty predictable, but they were basically associating anarchism with a state of like chaos or even just rioting, as opposed to like a set of ideas or even tactics. And I think this is, for me, like, I've seen a lot of this recently. Like, for instance, like, I just watched Kimberly Jones's, again, her viral video that was, that went pretty far. And it's actually really good, where it talks about the riots. And she kind of breaks down and said there's three types of people. There's protesters, rioters, and looters. And she said that anarchists were among the rioters and just wanted to f*** up. And that's just kind of how she identified them. And while, I mean, there's obviously like some truth to that, I think I'm just curious, how do you think anarchists can articulate to people that we are both a resistance movement, but also like a set of ideas and not just kind of like a de facto stance of like wanting to be chaotic?
Yeah, I think that that goes back to what I was saying about exposing the contradiction. I think if you're an anarchist and you want people to know what your politics are about, you meet their needs. So if you are in a community and people are in need of housing, what can you be doing as an anarchist to meet that need for them? What can you be doing? If people need food, what can you be doing to meet that need for them? People need healthcare. What can you be doing to meet that need? Then in the process of doing the work to meet that need, you let people know you're an anarchist, and you talk about your politics, and you talk about the way that you arrived there. And a lot of this is going to be a process that requires some real work that is going to go outside of people's comfort zones, because we're going to have to talk and engage with a lot of different people and a lot of different communities that are in need. And it may not be somebody you know, or it may not be the person who's like right next door to you. You have to, you know, step outside of your comfort zone and really engage. So I think that when you are actually being effective and saying, hey, we're here to serve people and we're anarchists, and that's the work that we're focused and prioritizing, that I think that that's going to start clearing things up for a lot of people, because they're going to say, well, you know, hey, the anarchist did this for me. The anarchist did that for me. I think that there might be a image that needs to be countered, because there might be too much emphasis on folks doing certain responses to all of the oppression that we're facing. So I think that when we overemphasize one part of our movement, or think that everybody has one role that they're supposed to be playing, a lot of times certain types of organizing and certain types of responses get prioritized. I think that when we do that, that it's a limitation. So ultimately, one of the things that has to be done is creating that survival economy, creating that infrastructure to really meet people's needs, because that is an immediate, important way that you can push back on the narratives about anarchists that are so pervasive. And so, you know, you have a lot of people who are getting this message directly from, you know, the media that anarchists are outside agitators, and that they're coming in and doing this and doing that. That stuff is being broadcast 24/7. So the work to counter that and to push back against that has to be strong work. And I think one of the strongest ways that you can do that is by making it clear who you are as you're doing the work to serve people and to, again, expose the contradiction and meet people's needs.
In 2015, there was a book that was literally just tweets of young people from the Baltimore riots. And I remember having a discussion with some friends about kind of like their argument was that that book was kind of like the answer to like, where was the James Baldwin of that generation? And I'm just curious, do you think in today's current context, a black theorist in support of black resistance and liberation could come to occupy the same sort of role as Malcolm X or Angela Davis or James Baldwin. And obviously those are, you know, very different people and involved in different things. But do you think that the way the media perhaps now is configured, that that would be impossible or not allowed or perhaps not even needed?
You know, I think that it depends on what we're really talking about as far as like what the role would encompass. Angela Davis is still alive. And she's still working. And I know that a lot of her work has been especially influential. And I think that people need to, definitely be, really informed on, Angela Davis's work around abolition and around prisons and policing. Her work has been pivotal. And it can't be discounted. But, in terms of like from a younger generation coming up and addressing the things that are happening around us, I don't necessarily think that there has to be a person who's a leader, you know, or a primary representative of a certain type of thought or anything like that. I think that we should actually be pushing back against the idea that we have someone who, you know, is the go-to and, that always is going to speak up when it comes to a certain topic. I think that, you know, Ella Baker, made it pretty clear when she said, you know, strong people don't need strong leaders. And I think that, we have to be building something that is, a movement filled with strong people. And so I don't really like to, engage in, you know, movement celebrity and this whole idea of being like a charismatic leader or anything like that. I think that stuff is really oftentimes kind of a relic of past movements that we don't need to embrace in this time. I think that now is a good time for us to be thinking beyond that sort of rationale, because it led to problems in past movements. It actually is the root of Black anarchism that I was just talking about. One of the primary issues that the Black anarchists who became frustrated with the Panthers had was they were upset about the leadership. And there wasn't a true democratic experience happening within the party across the board. A lot of people were not experiencing the direct democracy that they hoped for within the Panther Party structure. A lot of decisions were being made by the leadership. And there was a sort of Panther bureaucracy going on, you know, according to the black anarchists who came out of that. So in order to address, you know, that legacy, and the limitations within it, I think that it's good to push back on anything that could possibly resemble that now. In a way that's reasonable. I'm not saying that there is never going to be people that, you know, are really effective or are prominent and they are visible. I'm not saying that, because I myself, I think, engage in a level of visibility, that is obviously not the norm. But I think that how people engage that and what they're doing with it says more than anything. And we have to be critical about that. We have to be critical about it within ourselves, and the people who we're interacting with in order to be most effective.
For sure, yeah. I guess just to say one other point, I guess for those of us that grew up, I mean, you know, for me, like when I was getting politicized, like reading books like Revolutionary Suicide, and like Malcolm X's autobiography were very influential. And then like, you know, but are just like watching films like, you know, the Black Power mixtape and like seeing all these like people like on TV and speaking, and like they had like seemingly like a pretty large platform. Like I remember talking to somebody that was involved in the New York chapter of the Black Panther Party, and they were talking about the split that happened between Huey and Eldridge Cleaver. And they said, yeah, I remember watching that on TV, and that's how I learned about it. It just, I mean, it seems like so crazy that, you know, that's kind of like the platform they had. And like you fast forward to today where it's like the people that are kind of put in front of the cameras are just like woke neoliberals essentially or something like that. So it seems like there's definitely like a push to like, you know, not highlight certain voices, obviously. So I get, that brings us to our next question is what do you feel is the role of radical Black theory today?
I mean, it needs to be crucial in a lot of our thinking and a lot of our approach. And we also need to be critical. Like I was just saying, I'm not a person who is doing the sort of work that I'm doing because I'm just simply trying to replicate the past. People get into this habit of replicating and worshiping the past in this way that feels very limiting. And so when we start, you know, wanting to make things better, make conditions better, we have to, you know, have a real healthy understanding of critique and of study that brings us to a place where we can actually, you know, exceed the past, not simply try to, you know, copy it. So one of the things I mean when I say that is when I'm thinking about anarchism, for example, I think that like a lot of times people think that the goal was for me as a Black person to come in and try to diversify anarchism. That's not the goal. And to be even more blunt about it, I don't think that anarchism itself is the final destination. So the goal here is liberation. And I don't call liberation anarchy. I call liberation. So oftentimes people want this easy roadmap when we discuss things like abolition. And what we're doing is we're rejecting what's going on right now. We're saying no more to the current state of things. We're fighting for more control over our lives. We're for more resources for our health, for nourishment, until we can secure safety and peace. And so, in other words, you know, we're talking about, you know, direct democracy, and we're talking about you know, people making decisions over things that are happening in their lives with regard to their time and their labor and their resources. We're talking about dual power and building strong grassroots movements and that offer people another option aside from the institutions that are failing. You know, we want to thrive. We want to be free from oppression. And in the midst of discussing these things, a lot of times I feel like we start holding ourselves back by thinking that whatever our ideological position might be is the ultimate manifestation of what liberation is, and we start, and you see people conflate the two. So for me, I know that when we were working on As Black as Resistance, one of the things that we clarified in that text is that, you know, anarchism is a misnomer that we use out of necessity. And for me personally, I consider anarchism to be a placeholder that is ultimately something that I'm trying to exceed. I think that we should oftentimes think beyond what's available to us. And sometimes we're going to say, hey, this is something that makes a lot of sense. This is good for now, but how can we exceed this? How can we take it even further? How do we go left of anarchism? How do we go beyond it? How do we radicalize things that we already consider to be radical? And so in doing that, I am talking about a level of thinking and critique that will help us really evolve and grow our movements and our thinking beyond where we've gotten so far. And so radical theory is important in terms of our study and our education. But again, I think that we shouldn't limit ourselves, and we shouldn't get stuck on categorizations and labels and sectarianism in this way, where it feels like we're in some sort of club or some sort of cult. I try to really push back against that, because again, I'm not just trying to say, hey, this anarchism is simply the goal, and that then when that happens, it's done. Because we can't even do that realistically, because what we're talking about when we talk about liberation, and when we talk about freedom, and when we talk about abolition and the things that that make up a revolutionary change. We're talking about things that are so big in scale. We're talking about things that are so transformative that many of them are almost unimaginable to people. So in the process of making such huge transformative revolutionary changes, there's always going to be things that we learn and changes that happen and ways that we adapt to different situations that cannot be completely comprehended based on the information we have available to us now. So we have to learn as we go, and we have to create new theory, and we have to transform as we go. So along the way, there's going to be all types of different things that come and pop up, and we shouldn't limit ourselves and get stuck, making religiosity of any of these things. So that's really how I feel about it. I know I said a lot of different things there. Let me know if I can clarify any of that.
No, that was great. Well, we're going to switch gears here now and talk about a couple other things. I shared an article with you before we were recording, but Trump and the rest of the right have attempted to kind of both weaponize this whole blacks, gays, Latinos for Trump. Yet at the same time, they've really doubled down on white grievance identity politics. And, as we were saying before in that article, recently, Twitter has taken a bunch of bots off the platform for, basically they've been created to appear as black Trump supporters. And I'm just curious, your thoughts on this kind of albeit poor attempt at quote multicultural white supremacy, and what does that mean about today's society?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say about white grievance is, let's call white grievance what it is white supremacy. We have to be careful about, talking about that, because we're talking about white supremacists, and we want to be really direct with that language. White people have been having the same game run on them for centuries, and there's no excuse to be falling for any of this nonsense Trump is spewing when it comes to the capitalist ruling class. It's they're wealthier than they've ever been. If there were white people who were perceptive and intelligent enough to aid black conspiracies to revolt against slave owners or to defect from the Confederacy because they saw their exploitation in, and there's no excuse now. So these, you know, folks who, you know, would be considered under quote, you know, quote unquote white grievance politics, these are white supremacists who want to embrace their whiteness as a justification to subjugate and oppress people. So they're no different from overseers, police, and wardens that came before them. As far as Trump trying to appeal to people he hates, that's always been the case with white supremacy. You know, countless slave revolts were put down and betrayed by people saying that, you know, rebellious slaves were going to get everybody killed and going to get everybody in trouble. Black movements have always been infiltrated and disrupted by sowing discord and using manipulative tactics like this too. So this is how counterinsurgency functions in many ways. And so this is a classic attempt to use traitorous people or people who appear to be traitors to appeal to others. And the politics of representation works for both parties, as they both employ it to manipulate people. So the difference being, you'll find people within the Democratic Party structure who are actually sincere, maybe at one point, or maybe they got co-opted, or maybe they thought they reformed the system from the inside out. You can't be sincere working with fascists and the far right. You can only sincerely believe an impression on that end. So I think that, you know, it's not anything completely new. It's based in, you know, the fact that there's always going to be people that that get out there and try to appeal to oppressors and work with them to save themselves. And I think them creating, you know, fake accounts or anything like that just speaks to what they actually think of the people who they're trying to appeal to. So it's not completely surprising. It's puppetry either way. It's just a different type of puppet.
Yeah, very true. Well, we've talked a little bit about mutual aid programs. I want to kind of bring it back to that. And I'm just curious, you know, over the past couple of years, we've seen, you know, such a high bar being set. I mean, between people responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, to all the amazing things we've seen with autonomous disaster relief. I mean, from people like, you know, literally squatting like abandoned buildings in Puerto Rico and setting up like solar panel grids and stuff like that. I mean, we've had just so many people on this program, from indigenous anarchists, you know, talking about doing work where they live, to people like Simile in cities like Baltimore. So I'm just curious, you know, and I think you've said this already, but like, what would kind of like setting the bar even higher look like? And I noticed, you know, you brought up the Panther several times. I mean, like, one of the things that we've asked is like, you know, when are people going to be able to set up like, you know, clinics and like medical infrastructure? But I'm just curious, as we go into 2021, what does kind of the future of mutual aid look like, and what would it mean to even scale up what's already been done?
I'm really processing that myself. You know, one thing that Lorenzo has discussed with me when I've talked to him has been, you know, meeting the need around COVID, and thinking about how, again, the Panthers were able to respond to, the need of Black people and struggling, with sickle cell anemia. And so it's been done in the past, some unbelievable things have been done in the past to meet the need around healthcare and in the midst of public health crises. And that is something I feel like a lot of folks should be trying to figure out, you know, if they're not already. And so scaling up mutual aid and thinking again about the survival economy means identifying the most vulnerable spots and in our communities and finding resources to connect people with, and again, politicizing in the process, because it has to be an all encompassing thing where it's not, you know, just an act of serving people where we separate ourselves from our politics. Like, our politics are obviously the root of why we're doing it in the first place, and it has to be made clear while we're doing it. So, yeah, I think that scaling it up in the midst of the pandemic is going to mean addressing the pandemic, and not just the results of the pandemic as far as, you know, food and housing and unemployment, but also the actual pandemic itself and helping people in terms of getting access to things they need in terms of healthcare. So I think that that's one of the things that folks should really, really be prioritizing and thinking through as well, if they're not already, like I said.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to also ask, on the NPR interview, you mentioned that you're working on a new book. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. The book that I'm working on is called The Nation on No Map. And it is it's going to be a text that is dealing with a lot of different aspects of Black anarchism. And a lot of the things I've actually talked about in this interview. The interesting thing about it is I've been working on this book for years now. I was working on it at the same time as the Black as Resistance. And in the midst of writing this text, I was trying to expand again. In the same way that as Black as Resistance is an expansion, I was trying to expand again and address some of the things that I felt might be coming in the future. The sad part of this is those things are happening now. So, you know, as Black as Resistance was a book that talks and alludes to a lot of the things that are happening now, but I wanted to be a lot more direct about a lot of the things that are occurring. For example, in my original work to start, you know, putting this text together, one of the things I anticipated and thought would need to be written about was a public health crisis. And the need to be prepared for any sort of like outbreak or anything. Obviously, that is happening now. I also was planning to address self-defense and thinking about the conflict that could potentially happen in the U.S. In a much more direct way. And we see that, you know, we are in the midst of that conflict already. And, you know, not to say that we weren't then, but it's heightened quite a bit. And I also wanted to address other things like the nation, the idea of the nation. That's why it's called The Nation on No Map. And that's actually a reference to a Gwendolyn Brooks poem that I referenced in As Black as Resistance. So I wanted to try to do a lot of different things in this text, and there's a lot of things I wanted to just put out there for people to have as a resource. And actually, this current moment happening before I thought it would happen has completely shifted a lot of the things that I was planning to try to do in the text, and now I'm writing it a little bit differently. But it's gonna be a book that is straight up just talking about the reality of this situation that we're in, and trying to hopefully help some people think through some of the different responses that the Black anarchism that I write about and think through could possibly aid. And so that is a really basic way of understanding it. But there's going to be a lot of different subjects addressed. And one of the things I also do want to get into primarily is addressing the idea of the nation and nationalism itself. So that is, I think, an important task to try to address that and think through it in light of what I was talking about in the history and the legacy of Black anarchism turning away from certain strains of Black nationalist politics.
Is that going to be published on AK Press as well?
Yes, it will be published on AK Press. I'm not certain when the book is going to come out yet. Obviously, there's a lot of different things going on, but it is definitely coming. So it's a text that is completely going to be shaped and framed by this moment, and it's undergone a lot of changes because honestly, everything it's been responding to has been happening as I've been writing it. So it's something I hope will be useful for people.
Awesome. Well, we definitely look forward to that. Well, we've been talking for a while now. Really great to have you on. Anything else you want to talk about? And also, where can people follow you and support your work?
Well, people can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter is William C S O N, William Season. And if you want to contact me, you can do it there, or just check me out wherever you see me online. I mean, it's not really hard to get in touch with me. People always DM me and reach out and ask questions or want to engage in conversation, and I'm open to that all the time. So don't be scared to do that.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.